Good afternoon. It's approximately 1:35 on Tuesday, January 23. And let the record reflect that Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Representative Thompson, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Grimm and Tilton, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Chair Seaton, are here today. And before we start, I'll remind everybody about their cell phones or to check them again. And today we're going to hear an overview of the governor's budget by David Teal, the Director of Legislative Finance.
Oh, that's a good question.
Make his way up to the table. We'll also have a presentation on personnel services vacancy factors by David Teal and Amanda Ryder, who's also fiscal analyst with the Legislative Finance Division. So, Director Teal, would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division, and here to, as you say, go over the governor's budget. The presentation went about an hour and a half in the other end of the hall, and vacancy factor could take that long as well, so I don't know how you may want to split this. If you want me to hurry through this or just go at a pace that's right, or actually Brody had a great suggestion. He thought that Amanda could come up here at the same time and she could give vacancy on that screen while I'm doing the overview on this screen. And this screen.
I think we will give you our undivided attention, but I think that we will probably hold questions until the end, unless you would rather have them as we go.
I would prefer them as we go.
Okay, so that's what we will do, and we'll see what we get through, and if not, we will might have to extend, but these are both very important subjects, and we're going to be constrained working on the budget throughout. So I did also want to recognize that Representative Drummond has joined us, and I believe I saw Representative Birch a few minutes ago. So go ahead.
Okay, we usually start with the fiscal summary. It's perhaps the best way to get a feel for the fiscal situation and the governor's budget request, but the older I get, the harder it is to read that thing, and I don't even want to show it on the screen. The print is pretty small. For those who do want to look at it, it's on page 8 of the introduction, which or the overview of the governor's budget, the printed version, and you should be able to look at it there. For this high-level discussion, I think it's probably just fine to go with the abbreviated version of the fiscal summary, and I've got several versions of it, three, that each version covers UGF only and skips many details. And for those that don't know, I'm going to take a moment to explain why we look at UGF or unrestricted general funds only. That's because federal funds, other funds, and designated general funds, all three of those categories, you cannot spend more than is available to you. In other words, federal receipts come in, even though you're authorized to spend $1 million, if you get $700 million from the federal government, that's all you can spend. So there can't be any deficit on federal funds. The same is true of other and of designated. The only place you can have a deficit is in the unrestricted general funds category. And that's really what Ledge Finance is interested in. I know there are others who are also concerned about the footprint of government. And for those people, total spending is important. I don't want to say here that it isn't. I'm just saying that because we're focusing more on the deficit, we're limiting it to unrestricted general funds. So here's the first version of the fiscal summary. It's on a cash flow basis. And I'm going to start with the notes. You see here that revenue, which is about $2.1 billion, the note says that excludes transfers from their earnings reserve account. Some of you may find it, that means there's no POMV payout in the revenue. You can think of this as oil revenue. It's not really just oil revenue. It includes interest and some other taxes and things. But for all practical purposes, I think we can consider it oil revenue. Then you can see the appropriations totaling $4.6 billion. And as typically we do, it's broken down into agency operations, statewide items, and capital. And again, they exclude dividends, and it excludes transfers to or from reserves. There's a very small $21 million transfer from reserves, but it's excluded in this thing. We're also excluding items that require legislative action beyond a simple majority vote. By that, I mean no supermajority vote here. This is strictly the cash that we get without drawing from the CBR. And the reason for that is that we're trying to show you an accurate picture of the fiscal situation based on cash flow only, no drawing from reserves. So we've left that out. We've also left out bills, which we consider to be a fiscal note, but we're not going to build that fiscal note into the budget unless and until the bill passes. It also excludes an appropriation to purchase oil and gas tax credits. So again, it's trying to get a clean starting point so you can see how much corrective action is necessary. You can see that by simply taking the difference between revenue and appropriations and saying we've got a $2.5 billion deficit. Now, this is not the governor's plan. It reflects appropriation bills, no supermajority vote, and that's not strictly true because it says no tax credits, but you may know something about a debt purchase plan on oil and gas tax credits. If you believe the state owes the minimum statutory amount and we have to purchase those credits, then the budget's missing $206 million. The governor has taken the approach that, but I have a plan. I'm removing the $206 million from the budget or not showing it, and instead I'm going to come in later with legislation that allows me to sell bonds, and the interest on those bonds is $27 million. So you could argue that we want a fiscal note to do that. Whichever way you look at it, the governor did not request money in this version of the fiscal summary to purchase oil and gas tax credits. That's his prerogative. Even if the bill doesn't pass, he can say, I don't request any money to purchase oil and gas tax credits. If the legislature wants to put it in, that's fine. But he doesn't have to follow the minimum purchase in the statutory or in the statutes. So you may argue that this understates the deficit by $200 million approximately. So we're really at a $2.7 billion deficit. Either way, subtract the appropriations from the revenue. You're at 2.5 now, maybe 2.7, and you can say, well, we've seen worse, and you'd be right. We've seen deficits larger than this. But this year, there's a game changer. And that game changer is that the reserve balance shown here is both the CBR at 2.2 and the SBR at a little under $200 million, total $2.4 billion. Which is insufficient to fill the deficit, even before the $200 million for oil and gas tax credits. Now, that situation shouldn't come as a surprise.
Before we go on from that slide, what I'd like to do is go through the slide and then at the end of each slide get questions. So we have Representative Guerra Ortiz and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one really technical question. Last year there was discussion, when we consider what the state spends, and spending from your charts is down about $3.5 billion with capital and operating over the last many years. But what we show as spending has always been, has not included the spending on the permanent fund dividend, right? And there was some discussion last year that, that the governor's office or maybe some others wanted to start including the permanent fund dividend as spending. And the only reason that, and so I want to find out whether you, Ledge Finance or the governor's office plan on doing that. Do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the cash flow slide that you're looking at right now excludes the payout from the permanent fund to the general fund, and it excludes dividends. The governor's budget, which we'll get to in a moment, does treat that differently, and he includes a payout to the general fund and pays dividends from that payout, so dividends become a general fund expense.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah, I guess the governor can do that, so I mean, but I take it legislative finance is not going to do that for your budget. The problem, I guess I'll just present, is I had a constituent who looked at the governor's budget and thought the governor raised spending by $1 billion, and I knew what they were looking at was all of a sudden the cost of the permanent fund dividend was being included when, in, for Alaska's history, it never had been. I knew his budget wasn't up $1 billion. But what's Ledge Finance's view of that?
Through the chair, last year when Ledge Finance presented the budget, we included the dividend as general fund expenditures. We do that again this year in the fiscal summary. Not in this version of it, because we're only showing cash flow. What I'll walk through is two more versions getting you to the governor's view of the budget. Ledge Finance looks at it this way. The governor proposed taking money from the earnings reserve, putting it in the general fund, and paying dividends from that deposit to the general fund. We will show it that way because he can do that. We showed it that way all the way until the end of session last year, when in fact there was no payout to the general fund and there was an appropriation directly from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund. So it didn't go through the general fund last year, and that's the way we will show it for last year. Now, that's why you get these comparisons that are difficult to make. The way we make the comparisons equal is to say we're just going to show dividends last year as revenue to the general fund and an expenditure from the general fund so that you don't get that $1 billion increase in spending. It doesn't do any good to try to compare two different ways of doing things. And even though it's not technically accurate to say that dividends last year were paid from the general fund, we treat it that way to make the comparisons easier.
Yes, Representative Ortiz. And before we go to Representative Ortiz, Representative Kawasaki joined us a long time ago. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear, is the $27 million that the governor has set aside for paying interest on the bonds, if we go down that road to pay off our oil tax credits, is that in this number? Is the $27 million in this number?
Through the chair, that number is in.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So how about retirement or anything that might be DGF at this point, portions of it, when they're really everyday costs? Does that show up in here?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I'd rather answer that question by moving through the slides to get to the answer, so I think everyone can see how it works instead of trying to explain it before I'm the slides get you there. But that's the question we're trying to answer.
So just clarification.
Can we get to that point if the explanation is clear, then we'll come back to it.
And just a little clarification. So it's not just retirement, but anything that might, because we've had that discussion where everyday operating has been out of a different fund, so that it qualifies under DGF, although at some point those funds could run out and would be back here. So it wasn't just on retirement, but anything that we that might be in the budget that's DGF, but was only put there because higher education money might be available, but not necessarily what you would utilize it for. But I can wait until we have those. I just want to make sure it's not just UGF in the budget, some DGF stuff that actually may have probably been in UGF.
And again, through the chair, Representative Wilson, excellent point, because as you know, for the last couple of years, we've used higher education money to pay for retirement costs, reducing UGF expenditures for that purpose. This year, or last year, the legislature put intent language in there that said, Governor, please don't do that again. So the governor did not do that again. This year, he funds retirement directly from the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And that's another point of discussion that will come up later. So as the chairman said, when I get there, and if you still have questions, please ask.
Thank you.
Then. Okay. So what I was saying was that this situation with a having insufficient reserves to fill the deficit should not come as a surprise. Here is some output from our FISC model that we did back in 2015. And the model shows then that reserves would not last through 19. Now, the thing about projections, particularly unpleasant ones, is that they're just projections, and it's easy to ignore them, especially when you don't really want them to come true. But we're no longer looking 4 or 5 years ahead. The future's here. The reserves are essentially gone if you were to use the CBR to try to balance the budget this year. There's insufficient money to do so. So what that means is that alternative deficit erasing strategies, whether that's revenue enhancements, you can call them taxes if you want, or additional expenditure reductions, or using permanent fund earnings. All three of those are strategies that have been tossed around here for several years. All three of them have to be considered at this point. It's your decision which combination you want to use, but you do have to balance the budget before you leave, constitutional requirement. So the primary strategy, oh, should ask about questions before I leave the slide? Okay. The primary strategy that the governor proposed to close the budget is using permanent fund earnings. And that brings us to slide 4. And again, I'm going to keep the cash flow numbers on the screen and just add another version of the fiscal summary. Now, this time, what we're doing is adding POMV payout of $2.7 million, 5.25%. And of that $2.7 billion, 819 of it goes to dividends, leaving you with a net revenue gain of $1.9 billion. So you now have revenue of $4.8 billion. I want to emphasize that this is not the governor's plan. It's just a step in getting there. And the first step he's using is having a POMV payout, which goes a long ways. You also now are adding transfers. That's really pulling money from small accounts and funds. In this case, it's the capital income fund. You're taking more out this year than you're putting in by $21 million. So the math is pretty simple. You had a $2.5 billion deficit, and you reduced it by roughly $1.9 billion, leaving you with a $600 million deficit. That's a huge improvement. And after filling the deficit from budget reserves, you would have $1.8 billion left in those reserves. Now, some people, you can, well, I can just say you can interpret this as you wish. Some people might say that there's no need to panic, that $1.8 billion being spent at $600 million a year is 3 years before you're actually out of reserves if you continue funding the budget by having a POMV payout. Others might say, yeah, except it's really not 563 because the governor didn't include $200 million for tax credits. It's maybe underfunded for retirement, et cetera. But even if you just say 200, well, now your reserves drop to 1.6, and your deficit goes up closer to 8. Now you've got 2 years of reserves left. So it's pretty sensitive here as to how long this will last. You've probably heard several times that OMB and legislative finance would really prefer a year's worth of reserves in $5 billion, roughly a year's worth of spending in the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Account. But two is sort of a goal now that we're long past having five in it. And, you know, OMB has said we don't want to go below one for cash flow purposes. So you can look at this and say, if you do POMV, you made it through 19. But 20 and 21, you still have a deficit to fill, and it's going to be harder and harder to fill them, leaving you lower and lower reserves unless you do something else, raise taxes or cut spending. Slide 4 doesn't really bring us to the governor's plans. Okay. It doesn't bring us all the way to the governor's plan. You've got a supermajority vote left to take, and you've got bills. So now we can go to slide 5 and go to the addition of the third column, which is the governor's budget. And here, the changes are an additional $200 million in revenue, bringing you to a little over $5 billion. That revenue comes from a payroll tax of, in the first year, $160 million, and then motor fuels taxes generating $40 million. So $200 million additional revenue, but you're spending $309 million more. $29 million comes from fiscal notes on the three bills that he's built into his budget, and we say, haven't passed yet, but if that's the way you want to budget, we'll count them. And then the Economic Recovery Act. I said above that there was $160 million in revenue, and you may be familiar with that bill. It spends $280 million in the first year. So I think there are probably three issues, a small digression here on the Economic Recovery Act. The bill says the legislature may appropriate the balance of the fund. And, of course, the balance of the fund is the revenue from the tax, $160 million. So how you're not following the bill that says you can appropriate the balance if your balance can't exceed 160 and you're appropriating 280. OMB says, well, that's not a real problem. We don't intend to spend all the money that we appropriated. We won't spend 280. We won't spend more than the 160. To which we respond, well, then why did you appropriate it this year? If you're not going to spend it this year, why didn't you just hold the appropriation off until 2020? You'd have to ask OMB what the answer to that is, because we just don't count that way. We say we're not going to count expenditures. We would go crazy if we tried that, because there's capital appropriations every year that last for many years. We count it the year that it's appropriated. We do not count the amount of money that was spent on that project each year. It would require an incredible amount of work to track all that. So we don't. We count appropriations. And you say, well, if you appropriate 280 and there's only 160 in the fund, then there's no money to back it up and you can't spend it. Not true in this case, because the bill creates the fund as a subfund of the general fund. And if you over-appropriate from a subfund, you will automatically go up one level and spend the money from the general fund itself. So it's not what you intend to do, it's what you can do that we're worried about here. So we count it as a $280 million appropriation. And then the third issue on this bill is that it is a bill, it requires a tax legislation to pass. If that legislation doesn't pass, then what happens to the regular capital bill? Is it going to increase because maybe several items in the Economic Recovery Act are things that the legislature wants, but that the governor moved from the regular capital budget into the Economic Recovery Act, and if you don't pass the tax, then you may move 50 or 100 or whatever you choose back into the regular capital budget, increasing your deficit. And what we've seen now is that the governor's deficit with the new revenue, with the new appropriations and transfers, is now closer to $700 million. Now, the governor proposes filling the deficit with a firm draw from the Constitutional Budget Reserve account. In his fiscal summary, it is a $400 million draw. We show $425. So I will try to explain that difference. The governor's bill also includes, in addition to appropriating $425 million from the CBR, a reduction of CBR spending if savings in retirement are achieved, and the savings would come from reduced medical costs. Our view of that is, one, when you make contingent appropriations, meaning they're dependent on something else happening, like achieving savings, we put in the maximum value of that appropriation. They put in the minimum value. We use the maximum value because we want the legislature to know what could happen. We don't want to paint a picture that's rosier than we think it might be or that it could be. So the other problem there is that let's say that you do have a supermajority vote on the $400 million, and it turns out that you don't achieve the savings, then do you come back and get another supermajority vote for the additional $25 million? And we just left it as it. We don't want to go there. We say that the governor withdraws $425 million. If the savings are achieved, wonderful. It's better to spend less from the CBR than you appropriated, rather than be stuck spending more than you appropriated. Supermajority votes are not easy to get. So what you'll notice here is that you're out of balance. $600 million here with a $400 million draw, even using all of the budget reserves, including the SBR, gives you a negative number. You know that the governor must submit a balanced budget. I would say there's no constitutional crisis here. The governor backed into the CBR spending by saying, here's my revenue, here's my appropriations, I need this much from the CBR. And in putting together both his revenue and appropriations figures, we found some, errors is what the heck you can call them. That's what they are. He double-counted some revenue and undercounted some appropriations, so that I don't consider this a big deal. You show a deficit here of $74 million. He can fix that in the amendment process if he chooses to do so. It's just a math equation that got him to the 425. It could just as well be 500, and the deficit would go away. Any questions before I go to six? Okay, slide six is intended to add some perspective to the discussion. It's comparing FY19 to FY18. Now, you'd think that would be easy, but it is not as easy as you would think, because the governor released what he called a transparent budget report. That report showed a reduction from 18 to 19 of $150 million. Then you go to the fiscal summary, and it doesn't show that same $150 million reduction. It now shows a reduction of $257 million. And you'll see here that our fiscal summary shows an increase of $287 million. So that's quite a range, going from negative 250 to positive 280. We provided OMB with our 16 points of difference between our fiscal summary and their fiscal summary, and I don't think we want to get to that level here. This is an overview. I will say there were two primary issues. The first, the big one, is the $400 to $425 million spent from the CBR. The governor says spending from the CBR is not UGF spending. It's not unrestricted general funds. That's true. CBR is constitutionally created as another fund. But taking $400 million from the CBR and saying it reduces UGF spending isn't helpful at all, as far as I can tell, to the legislature. We don't count that way, and we don't think you should. It implies that you could simply take another $700 million from the CBR, and that would fill the deficit and reduce UGF spending by $700 million. Great. I mean, if that's the appearance that you want to give, is that you don't have a deficit because you filled it from reserves, I would say you're fooling yourself or fooling the public if you believe you can count that way. The second item is the supplementals. You may be aware that the operating bill and the capital bill contain a number of supplemental requests, FY18 requests. It's about $170 million. And in comparing 18 to 19, the governor adds those supplementals to the 18 numbers before he compares 18 to 19. And again, we don't count that way. We don't think you should either, because when you count that way, it's possible to increase the budget every year, but the numbers will show it's declining. It's a distortion that we avoid by saying we're not counting supplementals at all. And the other way to do it would be to count both 18 and 19 supplementals, but we don't know what the 19 supplementals are going to be. In fact, we don't even know what the 18 supplementals are going to be. We know what he submitted on December 15th, but you won't actually see a supplemental bill, the full bill, for another week. So we think you're better off leaving supplementals out of the comparison entirely. And that puts you up to, you know, almost all of the differences explained by those two items.
Representative Wilson and Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So do this, I understand what you're saying about the supplementals, but do they finally get added into, like, right now the FY17 actuals? Is that where you would finally see the supplementals put there, so we do know what was spent, not necessarily spent in that year, but that should have been, you know, I guess it is actually spent in that year, not when a supplemental came?
Through the chair, that's exactly right, Representative Wilson. You will see them in 17 actuals. And, you know, we do want to count them, and that's why when we go back historically, we often count actuals rather than simply management plan, because, you know, if you're not going to be counting supplementals somewhere, then there's this incredible incentive to simply underfund the budget. You know, you can, for instance, right now, you got a deficit of $600 million. Just underfund Medicaid and have them come back for a supplemental, and you'll look like you cut the 19 budget by $600 million, when, in fact, you fully expect that money to be spent. It's just a question of when you're going to count it, not whether it should be counted.
And a follow-up?
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
So how do we stop the supplementals? I mean, I know once in a while you'll need it because maybe an earthquake happened or, you know, something devastating. But we were underfunded by over $100 million for Medicaid that is now, you know, in this budget. And how do you make it to where, I mean, if I guess I just want to make it clear, if we choose not to pay the supplemental, then does the money not just come out, I guess, of FY19 because they still have to pay the bills?
Through the chair, several questions there. First, how do you stop it? Only you as a legislature can do that. How would you know how to stop it?
That's it.
You would fund, in the case of Medicaid, to their projections, assuming you can trust their projections. That's a big if, seeing the number of supplementals and how far off the projections have been from actuals. I should mention, perhaps, that because of that situation, we met with the Department of Health and Social Services staff during the interim and talked to them about participating in their projection process for two good reasons. One, it's we're not comfortable with their projections now, and we'd like to be comfortable. We'd like you to be comfortable with the projections. And second is that unless you're comfortable with the projections, they may not get the money they need to run their program. And that brings you up to your third point, which is if you don't fund the supplemental, doesn't it just get funded anyway? And the answer there is yes. Not in 19, but what happens is in a program like Medicaid, which is an entitlement program, people that are eligible are entitled to go get health care. When they go get health care, the state owes that health care provider for the care provided. The state pays it. We have to. And, you know, then you get your federal reimbursement. But the fact is, we spent a lot more on Medicaid in 17 and in 18 than we thought we would. So you've got a $100 million supplemental, 92 of it for Medicaid itself. And if you don't pass that supplemental, the department simply says, the money left the Treasury, we can't get it back, and we have to give it back to the legislature next year as a ratification. And for those who don't know, ratification means that you ratify expenditures that left the Treasury without an appropriation. Because the Constitution says no money can leave the Treasury without an appropriation. Well, I just described how money did leave the Treasury without an appropriation, leaving you with virtually no choice. When that ratification comes in, you, the government somehow, I mean, I don't, it's not a particular person, but you spent money without an appropriation, and now you have to ratify it by saying we approve that money going out. See, it's a long delayed appropriation.
Thank you.
Representative Pruitt and then Guerra.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to spend too much time here because I definitely want to get to the next phase of this. But I do want to, I mean, you've hit on something that I think is really important. How do we have that truth in budgeting, right? The amount actually spent in a particular year because of the supplementals is actually larger than what the initial budget that went out of here is. But you hit it on the head. I think what's being utilized right now is by adding the supplemental in, it makes it look like there's a reduction taking place, when in the end there might be a supplemental that again puts this budget over last year's. So I guess the question is, how do we ultimately ratify that situation? How do we ensure that we're having that truth in budgeting statement, that comment? I mean, how do we answer correctly when someone says, what is the budget? But at the same time, not put us in a position where then it can be utilized in coming years, that the budget tricks, the things that we understand but the public doesn't, in using that supplemental amount added on to the previous year to argue for a budget that's in front of us actually being a reduction or being cut or whatever may take place there.
Through the chair, you can work as hard as you want to minimize supplementals. You're always going to get them for things like fires, disasters, even some agencies. I mean, OPA and Public Defender routinely come in for supplementals. That's something that probably shouldn't happen. An agency for operating costs should probably not be coming in for 20-something years in a row with a supplemental because of constant underfunding. Medicaid is the same way. To the extent that you can fully fund the programs in the year, then you avoid the distortion caused by supplementals. You can't necessarily do that. Projections are just projections. And, you know, when you think of several million dollars in supplementals, remember that Medicaid costs run about $15 million a week. So that if you're off for 2 days of checks, which is, I think, pretty darn close, there's a $5 million supplemental, which is a big number. So I don't think you'll ever get to the point that supplementals can be eliminated, but they can certainly be reduced. And the other distortions in there are crossing fiscal years, you know, using pre-funding money like has happened. Other distortions are using designated general funds for non-designated purposes, using non-recurring sources of money, one-time money we would call it, for ongoing operating costs. All these things will come back to haunt you in the future and distort your year-to-year comparisons, making it hard for you, the public, and for us, frankly, to figure out how to compare 1 year to the next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Teel, when the administration presented on this Medicaid increase, their explanation was they didn't expand Medicaid programs. They actually had reduced Medicaid reimbursement to physicians, but even though they had reduced some costs, it was a factor of more people showing up with more claims, and under federal law, once they show up, you have to pay for them. Do you have any dispute with that? That it was that the supplemental is a factor of more people just being on Medicaid, demanding more services, rather than the Medicaid program becoming more costly on a more costly benefits, adding benefits, stuff like that.
through the chair, Representative Guerra. There are a number of things going on in Medicaid. Several people want to say it's expansion that caused this. It really isn't. Expansion added more people at mostly federal expense. There is some GF there, but that's not the driver here. The driver on this big supplemental is, as you said, we knew we underfunded Medicaid when we left last year. There were some people who thought it was underfunded by $30, maybe $40 million. But they also had hopes that Medicaid could contain its costs. And yet, it was the, not home health care, it was the day, I can't remember exactly what it was, the day AIDS, the hours didn't get cut the way it was planned. There were a number of things going on, one way or the other. I don't think the department would have agreed that they were only underfunded by $30 to $40 million. I can tell you there was an RPL that came in during the interim, which tipped us off that they were underfunded by somewhere between $60 and $100 million. So this wasn't a big December 15th surprise. The department would have told you that they were underfunded the day the legislature walked out the door. So does it do you any good to underfund that way? And as you said, no. Medicaid cannot control its costs. Once it's determined that you're eligible and that the reimbursement rate is this and you got the service, they spend the money. So it's a question of believing their projections and funding Medicaid at the level of the projections. May leave some supplementals. It may leave you with a little over appropriation. But until you do that, if you just say, well, we hope they can contain costs, you will end up with supplementals.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, David, thank you. I think it's an appropriate and interesting exercise on dealing with the supplementals and the whole concept of it. I mean, I think it's some parts of it are academic because at the end, whatever happens with Medicaid is one thing. The day after we sign the budget, fuel prices might spike, ferry system costs go up, DOT costs go up, we might have a crazy fire season, costs go up. You know, easily $50 million is not unusual. You know, last night we had we'd averted a potential disaster along all of our coasts that could have driven us crazy. So I'm not sure how we ever get away from supplementals. I don't know how other states deal with it in a different way. I think it's how we trust the supplementals and the projections and how we deal with it in the charts. Is there a better way of dealing with it in the budget documents, how we look at it, that will give us more confidence? Or have we evolved into a way that it's about as best as it can be?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, you certainly haven't evolved to the best that it can be. Look at the number that the governor submitted, $170 million. That's not the governor's problem. Really, it isn't. Most of that is things the legislature did last year. $170 million, $100 million of that is Medicaid. You knew it was underfunded. $24 million is Marine Highways. You know, that was some shuffling around between years that didn't work out as planned. There were some other uses of one-time money that, you know, you may remember that in the October session, I was in front of the committee explaining the holes that were left. Those holes weren't left by the governor. They were a result of legislative action. And, you know, you can go through here and say, and community assistance wasn't funded, and on and on, so that the bulk of this $170 million is holes that were left in last year's legislative process. They're not things that the governor came in and requested.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And just for everybody remembering, last year we had all reports as UGF and we had all GF. And that was to help get at some of the one-time money or DGF used to supplement UGF unrestricted general fund so that we would actually be able to know how much was totally being spent. And that doesn't compensate for not having accurate projections. That doesn't compensate for cuts or underfunding statutorily required services. If we make a cut to a statutorily required service, the administration is required to follow the statute and provide the service, and we've underfunded it, and then it comes back in the very next year. Mm-hmm. So those are things we need to watch out for. Hopefully in this legislature, we will look at all GF again and make sure that we're not using designated funds to pay or to make it appear that we are lowering our UGF deficit, because it's all state money. It's all being paid, and we have to have that. So in some ways, we're trying to get to transparency by having it understandable what is paid for. And I'm not saying that anything's perfect or that, you know, that was the way the budget was created last year. Same thing with the Marine Highway funds being used for Medicaid. That was allowed in the budgetary process. It wasn't anticipated to be there, but that's a hole that we have to fill this year. So I just wanted to make sure that as we go forward, let's all try and concentrate on making sure that we understand the impact of each of the things that we're doing. And Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, just real briefly on that. And I actually am I'm fine with the total GF conversation. I actually have no issues with that. One of the things that I think is a challenge, and this is actually the way the governor has presented so far this budget, and what I expect to be presented as the departments come through to us, is a focus, as we see in front of us, more on that UGF. And so I think the process of talking about the full UGF, and then having the departments come in with UGF, creates that challenge of fully understanding what is a deficit, what is the full deficit, what is the actual spend. So I think we have different numbers being spoken by different individuals, which creates a very challenge when we go talk to the public about what the budget is. And so I'd ask is, somehow we got to come to which one are we going to focus on so that we're in uniform. I think that's where people are confused with when we come out of here is, which one are we going to use as the baseline from which to communicate what our budget is? Anyways.
And just to be clear, we do have designated general funds. We do have categories of funds. And so if we want to see what our total spend is, we have to talk about all GF. That doesn't eliminate GF. If you want to focus on UGF, you can do that. The question is, we want to avoid trying to lower UGF by spending DGF for unapproved sources. I mean, we can do that. We can spend it outside of its designated purpose, but if we want to do that for the purpose of saying we spent less GF, then that's problematic and gives a problem with budget. So, but that's taken care of in the all GF function, because then at least we can see it. And we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, and I wasn't meaning this to get into a philosophical debate. I was wanting to make sure that what we're doing is, as we go forward in the subcommittee process and the finance committee process, that we look at these things and look at the impacts and make sure that as we go forward in creating a budget and the way we're going to look at the budget, that we know what holes we will build in or what impacts there will be in the future. So let's see, who did, was Wilson, then Garrett. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if we really wanted to be transparent and truly truth in budgeting, would it make more sense that we wouldn't have all these funds, that you literally had, just use the CBR, that everything was just in the CBR, SBR, I don't care which one it is, but to get the message out to what we're spending, and we wouldn't have to always come back with this UGF, GF, DGF, and who did what, since we're not supposed to have dedicated funds anyway, because we could use them for any purpose, would it not make more sense to go to a model like that, so then when we took money out of the pot, everybody would know that's how much money that, you know, we have as revenue, and then not be battling this retirement doesn't belong over here, or we should use this fund for this instead?
Through the chair, you'd have fit right in at the Constitutional Convention.
Thank you.
Because certainly the drafters of the Constitution intended that all revenue just went into the general fund and all appropriations fought on equal ground for their funding, so that the whole purpose of prohibiting dedicated funds, which we got around by creating designated funds, was to say that, you know, just name it. There's no such thing as a higher ed endowment. There's no such thing as an alcohol and drug fund where some UGF is diverted into a specific purpose. Alcohol and drug abuse should fight for funding with other programs without having funds dedicated or designated for that purpose. Now, sure, it would be easier to get rid of a lot of those designated funds. But every year, ideas for additional designated funds pop up. So it's you don't have designated funds unless they're created by the legislature. You could get rid of them if you wanted to. But they work for the purpose that they were created, which is to make sure that some programs are competing just a little more equally than others for funding.
And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. And not necessarily for discussion today, but I think it's a discussion we need to have, because some of those funds were set up with specific parameters, and sometimes the funds were supposed to be used, you know, for this, and then why you, and I'll use PCE as a good example, power cost equalization. From my understanding, and I probably need some more education on it as well, some money was supposed to be put into energy projects to help lower costs of energy. So at some point, we would no longer need something like power cost equalization, because we would finally bring electricity or wind or whatever it was to bring communities closer to being even. Now, I don't know whether that's, you know, whether they've met that or not, and there's a whole lot of other funds. But I think just understanding, because there's a lot of funds out there, why they were put there and whether or not they've even met what they were, and whether or not they're even needed at the level that they're at, especially if we're going to start looking at a payroll tax or other kind of taxes when we have these, because everybody's not on the same level playing field, because the higher education fund's a good example, where then when we don't want to cut a program, we take retirement out of it, or we take other programs we took for education from within it. So we've already started that dipping. So I think maybe understanding whether or not that's even necessary, because I know it's not a subject anybody wants to do, but I think it's time we have that discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just because this will come up, I think a holy trinity between myself, Representative Seaton, and Representative Wilson, but for transparent budgeting, you can make it look like your undesignated general fund spending went down by just funding education like was done one year with the higher education fund. And so it looks like you spent less on education when you didn't. Or one year, I think, retirement was funded in part with the higher education fund. And so that's a designated general fund. And so it looked like your undesignated general funds spending went down. I think what Representative Seaton is saying and what I am saying, and I think what Representative Wilson is saying, is the public just cares how much did you spend. Don't make one category smaller by making another category you hope they don't look at bigger. And that's why I think I also agree that at this point, you should just still get, you should look at general fund spending and CBR spending. That's spending. And because otherwise you do confuse the public if you say it's undesignated general fund that fund spending that counts. All you have to do is fund education or retirement or some other general government function with some other pot of money, and it looks like spending went down when it didn't. So, I mean, I tend to agree with Representative Seaton, Representative Wilson about that. And you, if you don't do that, then you can't really compare year-over-year spending. So I think most of us agree with that.
Mr. Chair, in response to both Representative Guerra and Representative Wilson, on page 16 of the overview, there's a discussion of designated funds being used for non-designated purposes. You can begin there if you want to start looking at, are these designated funds really useful? Second, I would say that it helps to know the history on some of these things. PCE, for instance, is the history on that is that many urban communities got hydro projects, and that meant cheap electricity for urban spots. Well, how do rural residents also benefit from the state's large investment in energy? And when you can't get projects out there, infrastructure built, because it's not financially feasible. So instead, the rural population shares in those hydro investments by getting their energy subsidized. How long? I guess one could argue as long as the hydro projects last. And they can go 100 years. So you can make the argument that the PCE fund was a good idea that allowed the whole state to benefit from investments that seemed to focus on urban areas only. You could go through every one of the funds and look at them and figure out whether they're needed. But I can tell you that every fund has a constituency, and that it's not easy to unwind history.
Ready to go on? Or one, Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, I mean, just one other thought on that, though. I agree that we don't want to unwind history, but I guess, and this has been my frustration for 4 years on finance, is I just really don't like how we get to the point where we have we try to lower the UGF. I think that's, one of my first times sitting here on finance, we had Pete Eklund come up, and he argued the reason we used UGF was because of the fact that that's where the deficit comes from. And so that's the driver that it is that we've had, is to lower what the UGF looks like, because that changes where that deficit is. And so if we were to start being truthful in our budgeting, and to the very point that you just highlighted, the designated funds being used for non-designated items, we'd have an initial, it would look like growth in our budget that first particular time frame. But we could finally get back to being truthful in terms of what we're actually spending in that that UGF. Because like this year, for example, $40 million, or last year, we used $40 million from designated funds to cover Marine Highway System. So automatically it looks like this year we've had this $40 million worth of growth. So, I mean, if we were to start off this year and finally be truthful and finally ensure that we're not using those designated funds to cover undesignated items, what would we expect the growth in the budget would be, and would that be a good position for us to start off this year in kind of resetting this clock so that we can actually have this truthful conversation with the public?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, you, it's a tough guess on what that would be. I would say it's several hundred million dollars. And, you know, I know that last year Representative Seaton said, we got to unwind some of this stuff. And then says, man, we can't do that because unwinding it appears to be a huge budget increase. And, you know, the it's just the nature of this building that everybody is looking for budget reductions, not increases. And to try to straighten something out, and, you know, good in the long run, great in concept in general, but it doesn't change the amount you're spending. It just changes the way you count it. And so how can the legislature fix it all when fixing it all is going to make the budget appear, the UGF budget appear to grow by several hundred million dollars? How will the public understand that it didn't grow at all? We just straightened out the accounting. There are a number of things you could do at legislative finance. We've been talking about designated funds not fulfilling its intent. We really intended designated funds to be more like program receipts, Marine Highways money that comes in from ticket sales and is used by Marine Highways. That's a designated fund. Park receipts, designated for parks. Those are all fine. But when you start getting into diverting general fund taxes, whether it's for reinsurance or alcohol and drug treatment or anything, that gets blurry. And we can change the way we count. It takes some work. It takes some agreement by the chairs to do that sort of thing. You know, I should go back all the way to supplementals because you were asking how we can straighten this out. And I think one way to reduce the distortion caused by supplementals is to count them in the current year. In other words, right now, you pass 18 supplementals, and, you know, last year you got credit for reducing the budget. Rightly or wrongly, you reduced it, right? And you may have intentionally or unintentionally underfunded things. But if you had to come back this year and say, we're not counting appropriations by 19, FY19 appropriations, so we don't count those 18s. You said, we're counting by legislative session. This legislative session spends the 19 budget and it spends the 18 supplementals. Then you would have no advantage to underfunding, right? Because if you took credit for cutting the budget last year, and now you have it comes back to haunt you, and you have to increase it, what good did it do you to get the credit for cutting the year before? So this is not a new idea. Ledge Finance produced reports like that probably 6, 7, 8 years ago. No one really looked at them or did anything with them. But at the time, supplementals were far less confusing than they are now. Supplementals were on the order of $50 million, and we thought that was distorting and tried to change the way it was reported, and it just didn't catch on.
And although it doesn't solve the supplemental dilemma following all GF, does fix the distortion of DGF, designated general funds spent to lower unrestricted general funds.
Right.
So as we go forward, look at those. We'll be getting reports with both sets of numbers so that people can follow the total budgets as well as the unrestricted general fund. So we need to go on.
Yep. So we've got a deficit. What does that mean? Beyond 19, we could show you the model. I don't know that you need to see the model because I think it's conceptually pretty easy. We've got a revenue forecast that pretty much keeps pace with inflation, and OMB's expenditure plan is basically inflation. And when you have both revenue and expenditures growing at the same rate, then your projected deficits are going to continue. Unless action is taken. And, of course, the size of the deficit depends on revenue. Increase it. Increase revenue, you reduce the deficit. Reduce spending, you reduce the deficit, or increase spending and you increase the deficit. The POMV payout, the larger the payout, the lower the deficit. But at the same time, the larger the share of the payout that goes to dividends, the smaller the share that goes to government, and therefore the larger the deficit. So there's a lot of variables that go into this, but I'd say that unless some fairly large action is taken, the outlook is for continued deficits after POMV of $600 to $800 million a year. So what's missing from the governor's budget? The item that I've gotten most phone calls on is community assistance, because people have said, well, I saw the appropriation for community assistance, so we're covered, right? And it's like, not really. When you think of community assistance and the way it's supposed to work, it's designed to be money that communities can count on. Remember that boroughs, other local governments are now preparing their 19 budget just as you are. Well, theoretically, they now know the 19 distribution will be $30 million. You remember last year, the governor did not request a deposit last year. The legislature didn't add it. And unless money is added before June 30th, the payout will be $20 million in 19. So the governor did put in a supplemental deposit to community assistance, which would fund 19 at $30 million. How much does that help local government now? Well, I'm sure they're pleased to see it's in there, but until it passes, they don't know it's in there. And, you know, we may not pass a budget until June again. Communities cannot plan unless they know in advance what's going into the community assistance program. That's why we look at it as nice to catch up and know what your 19 is, but this is the year that we expected the governor to say, here's a $30 million deposit in 19, which means that you know your 20 allocation will also be $30 million. So that next year you can plan your local budgets well in advance, knowing you've got your $30 million. It's a question of planning. There's certainly nothing illegal. The governor used money from PCE earnings as outlined in statute. He merely put it in FY18, leaving no money for 19. In our opinion, that's not how it was supposed to work. But again, there's nothing illegal, it's just inefficient. The retirement contributions, the June of 16 valuations for retirement called for state assistance payments of $299 million for PERS and TERS. The governor proposes 238, which is a shortage of $61 million. Now, you know what happened in Detroit, New Jersey, and Illinois? Many other jurisdictions that underfunded retirement, and it can put you on the brink of bankruptcy. It turns out that that this is perhaps not quite as bad as these numbers make it look, because the legislature included intent a couple years ago to try to eliminate the lag, the three-year lag in setting rates, and the ARM board now has an updated model for life expectancy and you know 200 some other variables for their projections, and they say the future looks better and that they can reduce payments by about $35 million. The other $25 million reduction here is something we already talked about, anticipated savings in Medicare costs or retiree medical costs. So, you know, you can argue whether this is $61 million short or $25 million short or whether it's short at all. I simply look at the valuation and say, if we were funding adequately, the funding ratio should be increasing. And you look at the numbers and you say the funding ratio is falling and is anticipated to fall for the next 5 or 6 years before it turns around and starts heading up. So retirement contributions are something that have been hanging in the background for 2 or 3 years, but because of the overall fiscal situation have simply never risen to far enough to the front burner that it gets your attention. I hope that you solve the fiscal situation in general and can turn your attention to this, and even if you still are working on solving that you can spread some of your attention to retirement systems, because I believe that if you look at those projections where, you know, we put $3 billion in 15, reduced the state assistance dramatically, and now you look at the projections, $300 million this year, it's going back up to $700 or $800 million a year. It's not something that I think you want to happen. So, you know, it may be underfunded, but I think more importantly to me is that I think the legislature really needs to take some time and look at the retirement funding issue.
Any questions? Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I'm sorry if I missed this. Just say you missed it and move on. But when Governor Parnell proposed the extra $2 or $3 billion to come out of the CBR, so that we could at one point there was a promise that future retirement contributions would be about $150 million a year, and I know that changed, but what is changing so much that now you're talking about it possibly going up to $800 million a year? Or if you said that already, then I missed it, and I'll ask you afterwards.
Through the chair, I didn't say that. What I said is I think it's worth your attention to look into that and find out why it's going up, what you can do about it.
Any other questions? Everyone understands the community assistance. There's no questions on that portion of where that other $30 million is not in the budget for the coming year.
Okay. Now turning to what's new in the governor's budget, there's a public safety action plan. I know you heard Pat Pitney talk about that. I don't have much to say. It's an increase of spending of about $33 million, 18 of which is a proposed supplemental. Then you've got the economic recovery plan. As we discussed, the payroll tax would generate $160 million in 19, but over its three-year life, it's supposed to be bringing in about $800 million and spending $800 million. What I find interesting is the change in the governor's attitude about the tax. Remember that when the tax, whether it's income, payroll, sales, or whatever, was proposed, it was because he believed we had to fill the deficit. And now there's a tax proposed that does nothing to fill the deficit. Every dollar generated f- from the tax is spent on capital projects. There's a very different philosophy this year than it's been in the past. And I've already mentioned the impact on the regular capital budget if it doesn't pass. And some other new things, the appropriation from the CBR. I think that's a conceptually very interesting move. It wasn't necessarily to speed or to use the CBR. The intention was to speed the budget process. And you do that by saying, we've got enough money from oil revenue and the POMV payout to fund core services, that being schools and state agencies. So let's fund them. Let's pass a budget that contains those items on time or early, if you can, and then say, well, now we've avoided layoffs in school districts and state agencies and perhaps municipalities, and you've avoided all the inefficiencies that go along with that. So very interesting idea. And then you take the minimally disruptive items, which he's identified as debt service, retirement contributions. They're important. I don't think the governor is claiming they're not important. He's just saying that if you fund the people first, then you don't waste the people's time talking about the budget planning that they need to do and whether they have jobs. You set those items up with a supermajority vote that don't involve people. So, interesting, but I see some dangers. Once you fund debt service and retirement with the CBR vote, supermajority vote, they are guaranteed funding, right? But it's your core services that are now funded from general funds that are vulnerable to revenue failure. And by that, I simply mean oil doesn't come in where you thought it was going to come in. You had a balanced budget, and let's say that you're $200 million short on oil revenue. Now you end up with, well, I don't have authority to draw more money from the CBR. I'm just playing short of money. What do you do? And it may mean that you have to come back for a second supermajority vote, or what happens in most states is a round of budget cuts, or in Alaska it could mean, well, let's just pull some money from the ERA, which is, I think, not a great option. If you're going to be pulling money from the earnings reserve on a POMV basis, you want it to be sustainable, not to go in and draw unplanned, unscheduled, ad hoc, whatever you want to call the draws, that actually erode your future payments. So I think that the approach is interesting, but it needs a little help to make it more workable. The governor proposed biennial budgeting. Same issue. Theoretically, it's much more efficient. You just spend your time on budgets every other year, and that gives you a year to do non-budget items. Well, I meet with my counterparts in other states, many of which have biennial budgeting, and I don't see them having any gains. They are back in their off year doing the same thing they did in their budget year. They're spending their interims having essentially finance committee meetings, full finance committee meetings, all interim long, looking for, well, they're scrubbing the budget, like what would happen in a subcommittee. So I believe that the advantages are more theoretical than practical, but it's worth discussing. I'm sure you'll get legislation because it requires legislation to do it, so you can talk about it when the bill is in front of the committee. Debt financing for purchases of oil and gas tax credits, can't say a thing about it. I don't know anything. Not enough to tell you that I think it works or doesn't work. Everything we've seen is just sort of a, well, there'll be some discount and some bonds, and but until I see a spreadsheet and a bill, I can't comment. We've talked about the supplemental appropriations being in the bill. I don't know how much else is coming. I know that people in the past have said, get these supplementals out of the operating bill. We want to start with a clean bill. That's fine. But there's no technical or legal reason that you can't have them here. It's just an appropriation bill, and any appropriation can go in any bill. You just change the title to incorporate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, I just want to use, just since you've sat down with people who do the biennial budgeting, and we're probably going to hear more about that, this is just my concern, and I'm just wondering whether or not it's a real concern that you've heard from other folks in other states or not. My concern about biennial budgeting is that you'll ignore the reality of inflation. So you'll if you budget for 2 years, you might not recognize that in year two the same services cost a little bit more just because of inflation. And the example I would use here is, I think in 7 of the last 9 years we've flat funded education, and then there have been two bumps. Not to belabor things, 1 year there was a $43 million bump, and then that disappeared, and then over the next 2 years you added $30 million back, and so you were down $13 million. But so in the second year it seems like you'll be coming in and saying, well, this service, education or the university or Medicaid, we flat funded when we did the 2 year budget, but we realized there's the reality of inflation, and now we have to rebudget the second year. Is that something that happens in these biennial budgets? Is that not a concern?
And for the committee, what I'd like to do is not get too deep into something until we have the bill before us, because I mean, you can address at a high level, but yeah, but we don't have a bill before us, so I'd really like to wade into a deep discussion on biennial budgets until we get there. But if you want to respond,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Guerra, I don't have a lot more to say than I already said. You're right; those are some of the issues with biennial budgeting. But I'd also point out that our budget process, incremental budgeting process, means that 95, maybe more, percent of the budget's the same every year. The subcommittees go over increments and decrements, but you could essentially pass a budget for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, but as you say, you're missing some inflationary increases. That's an easy thing to take care of in the process. You simply appropriate more for the second year. But I agree that until you have a bill, unless and until you talk to states that do biennial budgeting, it's really hard to imagine the changes that would actually fall on the legislature.
Thanks.
Thank you. And okay, so I think we're done at this point with this, and we're up. Is that correct, or do you have more?
We are. I mean, there's other items that, you know, some people would say, well, you missed, you didn't include these. I would just say, well, it's an overview. I can't talk about everything. I think if you want to get into more detail, I recommend reading the subcommittee narratives, read the language. It's in the written overview, but you know, it's just too much to go through on a slideshow. Also, I should probably close with saying that I didn't bring the model, but you all know it's there. You know that there are some massive changes in the model, both in terms of revenue forecast, permanent fund earnings, and that the outlook under that model has changed. And if you want to see the model individually or in groups, please talk to us.
Great. Thank you for that presentation, David. Let's go right into the vacancy factors. Amanda, you want to join the table?
Okay, I might need Helen or someone to tell me how to get it to slideshow because I don't see it.
Go to view. There should be full screen mode. Page display.
Page display.
It's showing up differently for
Google.
If you could have that
on the new upgraded system.
I think it.
There. Yeah, there we go.
And then into view. Full screen mode.
There we go. It just didn't look right. I'm used to seeing. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Amanda Ryder with Legislative Finance. And you've requested that Legislative Finance provide information on personal services costs, particularly the practice of underfunding positions to account for turnover, and also to provide guidance on how to find information on vacant positions and how to discuss how to determine what funding is available for positions and how deleting the wrong fund source may impact departments and their ability to perform their duties. Oh, all right, we need to decide who's.
I didn't know you could do it with
I
that.
Can.
I thought you had to push the arrow, so I'm a technological challenge.
All right, I'm going to begin by defining the vacancy factor. A vacancy factor is the difference between the amount needed to fully fund all positions in a budget and the amount of personal services funding that's included in the budget.
Well, and I was the one who wanted these to appear as equations rather than words. Maybe I'm just a nerd, but I find that sometimes equations give you insight that the words don't. You're all familiar with the OMB position detail reports. They list each position and the cost of filling that position on the report. Now Amanda's going to talk about two factors that cause an agency to have less money than the budget implies, the position reports imply. And the first is the vacancy factor itself, and then she's going to move into another more complicated source. And I did some simple algebra on this and got a second equation. And it's just that the budgeted funding equals the cost of filling minus vacancy factor. And I don't know why the slide kind of wrote over itself, but I think you can still read it. I think the second equation makes it clearer that the amount listed for each position in that personal services detail is not the amount that the agency gets. The amount the agency actually gets is what's listed in the personal services detail minus some amount that we call the vacancy factor. And I think that's critical in that many people fail to grasp. They see a dollar amount associated with a position and believe that that's the dollar amount that the agency gets. So it helps me, and I hope it helps others, to restate the definition, which is the first equation, at the budget request. And We refer to it, you know, as the vacancy factor. The second equation emphasizes the fact that the budget purposefully underfunds positions.
And you may ask, why does the budget purposefully underfund positions? And that really is, it's based on the assumption that newer vacated positions do take time to fill. So if you actually fully funded the position, you'd be overfunding what you need for personal services. And that depends on the size of an agency. If you have three people in a division, you probably need 100% of your funding. If you have 600, you probably don't. You won't have every single one of those positions filled at any one time. And that is the reason for purposefully underfunding personal services. So who determines the appropriate vacancy factor? Simple answer is that OMB determines what they provide guidelines. Generally, the higher number of full-time positions equates to a higher vacancy factor, as you can see from this slide. I do want to reiterate that these are guidelines. These are not set in stone. Slide 5 provides a graphical illustration of the vacancy factor. OMB sent us over some information on executive branch agencies. These are not statewide, so don't look at the statewide totals and look at this. These exclude the university and the legislature and the judiciary, but they sent us their vacancy information on executive branch agencies. And to fully fund all 16,228 positions that are represented in this graph would cost $1.83 billion. However, what they have in the budget is $1.745 billion. That is they are underfunded in the budget, in the 19 budget, by $90 million. That's basically the equivalent of about 796 positions, unfunded positions. I would also like to emphasize that of the $1.745 billion of funding, generally about half of that is non-UGF, comes from non-UGF funding sources. And all personal services funding is based on the fact that you can collect 100% of everything that is budgeted. With those non-UGF funding sources, it is rarely the case that you collect 100% of the funding that is budgeted.
And Amanda will get deeper into that in a few slides.
Question?
Amanda, I'm sorry. I didn't understand the last thing you said, but now I can't even restate the last thing you said.
Okay. When you have personal services funding, through the chair, Representative Garrett.
Funding is not there if it's non-general fund funding, you said something?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, yes. When the personal services line item is based on receiving 100% of the funding that is budgeted for that position. But about half of positions in the state are budgeted with non-UGF fund sources. We count UGF as available for appropriation. As I stated, up until now, that has been the case. Let's hope it happens in the future. But non-UGF funding sources are program receipts, other funds and federal funds, and many times there's more authorization in the budget than there is the ability to collect the 100% of that funding. And I will provide an example of that in a few slides, and I think you'll see an example of issues that come about with those other fund sources. On slide 6, how do you find vacancy factors for individual divisions? The personal service detail report in OMB's, the big black binders that are behind you on both sides, as well as on OMB's website under their budget reports tab, provides personal services expenditure detail reports. I'm going to highlight two things of note in this particular slide. The first is the vacancy factor. This is how you find out how much they're short funded. The arrow to the right provides, you see a total pre-vacancy amount. That's $50,894,464. That is the amount to fund at 100% all 598 positions in Pioneer Homes. Now, they are short-funded by $739,064. That's approximately 7 to 8 positions that they're going to have to keep vacant to live within their budget. That is the vacancy adjustment of 1.45%. That's their vacancy factor is 1.45%, or $739,064. Now, the total post-vacancy, this is the funding that's actually included in their budget, is $50,151,400. That's the funding put in their budget. In some other agencies, you will see lump sum payments, premium pay. Those are costs not associated to specific positions, but they're additions. And then at the bottom line, the personal services line, that is the number you will see in your, you know, that's allocated for personal services costs in that allocation. Over to the left, I am really going to highlight the funding sources used because those are very important when looking at the amount available for personal services costs. You see a multiple funding sources for in the Pioneer Homes. And left column is the pre-vacancy. That's the cost of funding 100% of positions. The post-vacancy is that $50,151,000, and that's the amount that is appropriated or allocated for personal services costs in their budget, and you can see how much of each of those types of funding sources is appropriated or requested for personal services costs. However, I'm going to look at the next slide. It's actually not. On this slide, the problem with these funding sources, many of them are not, they're not 100% collectible. So if you collected 100% of all this fund, of all of these fund sources, you would have $50 million to pay your positions, and even at that, you're underfunded by $739. We've heard rumors over the years that there's $300 to $400 million worth of slush funds available in the budget. And one of the issues, I think, from uncollectible fund sources is that it perpetuates this myth. And we don't know how the number was derived, and we can't duplicate it. But if true, that would mean about 14% of the total personal services funding would be diverted for other purposes. So I'm going to kind of let's look at the personal services, the total funding cost for Pioneer Homes. 54% is unrestricted general funds. This is collectible. GF Program Receipt Authority in the Pioneer Homes is received from residents who pay for room and board and other incidentals, and they pay those fees. Interagency receipts are primarily from Medicaid billing for Medicaid recipients who live in the Pioneer Homes. And the Statutory Designated Program Receipts, this SDPR, is received from pharmaceutical sales. So, and then the federal receipts are from the Palmer Veterans Home, and that's $694,600, and that's received from the per diem payments that the feds pay, the Veterans Administration pays for veterans living in the Palmer Pioneer Home. Well, is this funding collectible? And based on an analysis between the FY17 authorized budget and the actuals that were received, about 20% of this pot of money was uncollectible. And these are the fund sources. Pioneer Homes in 17 had to transfer $171,000 of UGF from other allocations in order to address the funding shortfall. GF program receipts, well, $1.6 million, 9.2% of the amount that they were authorized to spend was not collected, not expended. Interagency receipts, There was $2.9 million in interagency receipts. They just weren't able to bill for Medicaid like they wanted to in their budget. Statutory designated program receipts, you know, 28% of the $3 million was not collected. In total, $5.3 million of their non-UGF fund sources were not collected. That's about 19% of their budget. Slide 10 highlights the difference between a budgeted vacancy factor, and this is really, this slide I think is an illustration of how these uncollectible fund sources can really impact a division's ability to hire positions. 81% of the Pioneer Homes budget is in personal services. This first column of numbers, it matches your slide back here, the $50.9 million, and that's your pre-vacancy, the full cost of filling all positions. Then we have the post-vacancy money is the third column over, and that's the money that is actually requested in the budget. And this is actually the vacancy factor. This is 1.45%, which is the vacancy factor applied to the pre-vacancy. And so you can see that each one of these fund sources actually are reduced to get to your post-vacancy money. This is the amount requested. This is the amount that's actually in the budget. Well, when we looked at the revenue, and you realize it is very unlikely that Pioneer Homes, they've raised rates by 15% over the last few years, and they have gotten to raise their GF program receipts. They have had a big push to get everybody eligible for Medicaid on Medicaid that is possibly eligible for Medicaid. So it's not likely they're going to get another couple million dollars in Medicaid receipts. So I don't see a lot of changes in Pioneer Homes that makes me think that they can significantly increase these other revenue sources. And as a result, what I've done is we have said, okay, whatever they received, we're taking that ratio and we're plugging it into the 19 request. We think it's a reasonable amount. And in essence, at the 1.45% vacancy factor that's in their budget, you would have to keep 102 vacant months per year in order to live within your budget. Or that's the full-time equivalent of 8 positions vacant. In reality, we think the vacancy factor is more like 8% per year, which means you're going to have to keep 47 positions vacant and 567 months vacant to live within the budget unless they transfer money from other line items, et cetera. So when you're going through, so this is what we would consider a more realistic vacancy factor. If you decided to say, wow, I'm going to cut $4.1 million of UGF out of their budget because they can't collect it, well, you're going to have a much more significant impact on Pioneer Homes' budget. They're going to have to reduce another 47 positions if you decided to cut that in UGF instead of the appropriate funding sources. Do you want to add something?
Well, yeah.
Let's go back for just a minute. You're saying that if you reduce the budget by UGF, you're actually increasing the percentage that's coming from these other sources. Is that theoretically coming from the other sources?
Mr. Chairman, the feds are only going to pay the per diem rate that they're going to pay for the veterans that are in the home. You can't get additional federal receipts unless you get additional veterans in the Pioneer Homes. So if you cut UGF, it means you're going to be cutting positions that will serve the veterans in the will serve the residents of the Pioneer Home, because you're not going to be able to just say, oh, well, I'll increase federal receipts. And the same in these other items. Unless they increase revenue, unless they increase the number of paying residents or the rates and even then you don't know if people will end up going elsewhere and you'll lose revenue. I mean, there are risks associated with that. Or you end up somehow am able to collect more in Medicaid, cuts to UGF will cut services because that's the only real money that they're able to receive because they have so much excess authorization in their budget at this point.
And I did want to say something because I think it's important to point out here that the $5 million that isn't collected of these various, the total of $5 million that isn't collected, that cannot be a slush fund that can be diverted to other purposes. It's money that didn't materialize and therefore can't be spent. It's sometimes referred to as hollow authority or uncollectible receipts or, you know, whatever you refer to it as. It isn't real. And you can see here that when you look at the amount that's uncollectible and you say, well, 59% of interagency receipts are actually going to be realized, then you can say that of the 4.8 million in your budget, what you're really going to have available to you is about two. You add those all up about all of your unrealized receipts and you get another $3.4 million. That's additional forced vacancy. And now your total vacancy is $4 million that is in your budget that is not available for you to spend.
And I'd like to recognize that Representative Parrish has joined us. Are there questions? Yes. Representative Garen Wilson.
Can you go back to page 10, please? So I understand the $739,000 vacancy factor. The $4.1 million that was unrealized, is that the agency then having to make internal cuts that they did not plan on having to make?
Through the chair, Representative Garam, since FY15, UGF has been reduced by $3.4 million in Pioneer Homes. And designated general funds has gone up by $2 million, and other funds have gone up by $1.6 million. If you look at total funds, it looks like nothing's happened in this budget. It looks like why would the Pioneer Homes have increased waiting lists, which they have, their waiting lists have increased over the last few years. And why are they not able to hire their positions? Their budget is actually about $400,000 higher since FY15. Well, that is because of the fund sources. And this is why this is one of the difficult aspects of using general funds. Is if I look at general funds, I do not see that there has been a fund source change to say, okay, we want to collect more from the residents and we're providing less state subsidy to the Pioneer Homes. So it's hard to see what's happening in the budget if you look at all general funds. It's a lot easier to see what's happening in the budget if you look at UGF. In some other agencies, it's best if you look at all general funds. So you really have to know what comparisons you should be making, and so not all comparisons are equal. But in Pioneer Homes, the best comparison to say what is happening in the Pioneer Homes and what impacts their ability to hire positions is to use UGF comparisons. Excuse me.
So we have $50,151,000 of funded position. I mean, that's the budget. But there's 10% of that money that is non-unrestricted general fund that is non-collectible. So they really have only $45 million to run a $50 million budget. And is that correct? So that then you're saying they're leaving positions vacant because that's the only source of UGF money to run that $45 million that $50 million budget on $45 million is to leave positions vacant to not spend $5 million on positions?
Mr. Chairman, I would say yes for the most part, except a lot of the non-UGF fund sources are available. They're just not available to the degree that is included in the budget. And that's why we did the projected available funding. This is a projection based on 17. Talking to the department saying, what do you think about these? I haven't talked to the department about this. Maybe they are planning to increase their rates. I don't know. So until you talk to departments, say, are you guys planning to expand your ability to collect these non-UGF fund sources? You won't know, but I think this is probably a fairly good estimate of what they can collect, and I think that Pioneer Homes probably needs to clean up their budget because there are some real disadvantages of presenting their budget in this way to them. And one of those disadvantages is that when salary adjustments and health insurance increases occur in the budget, it is calculated on the fund sources that are used to pay personal services. And those fund sources in FY 18 and 19, I didn't look at the 19 budget earlier, but when I calculated FY 18 and 19, there's $582,000 of health insurance increases incorporated into the Pioneer Homes budget. That's no additional services. It's really just increased costs to pay increased health premiums for employees. $222,000 of that increased cost is not UGF. It is hollow authorization, meaning that you're going to have to cut a couple of positions just to pay for that, because you're going to have to use UGF. I really don't think of this $4 million, you're going to be able to collect enough of that extra revenue to pay for this extra $222,000 that was in their budget in 18 and 19 for health insurance. So it's if I were in charge of their budget, I would clean up these fund sources so I get more UGF, which is a more accurate representation of the funding needed to fund personal services in this budget.
And so the fourth column in the realized revenue budgeted funding, the percentages that you have there, you're saying that to get projections accurate so that you're not underfunding the budget with uncollectible funds, those percentages should be adjusted to 100 and reduce the projected amount that you receive, basically truing up what you're actually able to collect from each of those fund sources. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, I would try to clean up some of this excess and hollow authorization in the budget. However, the takeaway from this graph is when you have non-UGF fund sources, the true vacancy factor can be a lot higher than what appears in the budget. And funding that doesn't exist can't be spent. And be very, very careful when decrementing fundings in allocations with multiple fund sources. For example, I am going to turn, well, we're going to see another report in just a minute that shows when you're looking down at Pioneer Homes positions, each position is allocated to about 60% of UGF. So if you're cutting a position, you would say, well, I'm going to cut UGF. Well, if you cut UGF, they spent all of their UGF. It's these other funding sources that are the problem. So if you cut UGF with an associated position, you will be requiring them to cut even more positions than they're currently cutting. So you just have to look at positions as a pot of money and understand the impacts of cutting UGF or any other fund source you have or adding. For example, when you are adding $3 million of other DGF and other funds and reducing UGF, they weren't able to collect it. There was a real cut in Pioneer Homes. You added one type of fund source, you decremented another. They had to start keeping positions vacant. And if you cut UGF and add other fund sources again, you will then have to keep cutting positions. So be very cautious when you're looking at any position information to look at the total funding and your funding sources.
Questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on a different note, so I was looking at the governor's executive office and on the vacancy portion of it. So last year, they had a vacancy rate of 4.6%.
Are you looking at one of the slides?
No, it's not, but it's just on this. I'm sorry. I just found this as I was going through the book. And so it shows 433,000 approximately as their vacancy rate for last year. This year, although they have 69 people instead of 66 people, the vacancy rate was cut down from 4.6% to 0.74%. So now their vacancy rate's only 68,073. So does that mean that now they can actually spend more money because of that vacancy rate has now decreased and make it seem even? I'm just trying, because it's all UGF, so we know it's all realized. I'm just trying to, what is the takeaway when one year you had a higher vacancy rate like this of over 400,000, now you're down to 68,000 on the new vacancy rate? Does that then allow them to spend more money but look like the same, on paper would look the same?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I would have to take a look and say, did they delete a vacant position from the prior year?
No.
Okay.
Added.
They added?
They went from 66 people to 69 people. So I'm just trying to understand the vacancy thing in itself as we're looking through the books. You know, and back to understanding how many vacant positions, because obviously there would be a big difference if I got, there's 433,000 I can't use, they have to stay vacant to cover the vacancy rate in this budget, versus now it's only 68,000, I'm going to have, you know, less to do that. So as we look and see those, especially with all UGF, we know it's all realized, so we're not worried about that. How, you know, what should we take, I guess we're just asking what we should take away as we're looking at that.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I would have to, first of all, I would ask, well, you know, did funding increase? And I don't know. I mean, I don't, I'm not familiar with that budget. I'm not familiar with that allocation. That is some place that I would go and ask the department, hey, you know, why the difference in the vacancy rate? And I'm not sure.
And a follow-up? As we're on these slides and we're trying to clean up, let's say, a hollow receipt, federal authorization, because they could always come back if they find a grant or something happens, then how do you also then look at general fund match that was actually attached to that hollow receipt? Or do you just take out the federal amounts but the general funds stay the same? Because like you just said, you had them matched up. So if I take out what may not come, have they also not asked for more general funds they need to because the federal funds are going to come or possibly not come?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I would tend to look at, was that GF match spent? And if that GF match had been expended and they had hollow authorization, then I would know they needed that in the budget. Removing hollow authorization should not impact the amount of GF match that you would need.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions at this point? Let's try and keep our examples onto the slides that everybody has so that we can see them on the board.
Just doing my homework, sir.
That's fine. I just want everybody to get out of this overview and so we can see all these on the board. No other questions at this point? Okay.
So how am I supposed to find out which positions are vacant, how long they've been vacant, and why they've been vacant? Well, there was a new report from OMB. I'm going to be turning to that. That provides information on which positions are vacant, how many of the prior 12 months the budgeted positions have been vacant. And I would advise for information on the whys of why they are vacant, talk to the department.
And I'd just like to provide some background on this report. we've recognized that vacancy, position count, whatever you want to call them, personal service funding is a long-term, widespread problem. It's frustrated us. It's frustrated OMB. It's frustrated legislators, staff, and particularly Ledge Finance and OMB, because we seem unable to explain the issue in terms that legislators and the public can understand. And, you know, it's been difficult to come up with a way to explain that it's not just vacancy factors that matter. It's fund sources. It's when was a position filled? Is it if you have eight positions unfilled, does that really mean you've got eight empty positions? And the answer is typically no. So we met with OMB during the interim and tried to find a better way to present. And Will, their IT guy, came up with this report, which we love. The boxes tell you with a check mark whether a person actually got a paycheck. In other words, was the position filled? The empty box means it wasn't filled. So it tells us really simply that if it says your position, your vacancy factor is 739,000, and that equates to eight positions, you don't have eight positions vacant. You have a bunch of months here for this position, and a couple months here, and a month there, and a month there. And if you add them all up, they add up to the equivalent of eight full-time positions. So it's difficult to delete one position because it's not one position that's vacant. It is a whole bunch of positions with turnover. That's the vacancy factor. Now, this report to us really makes it obvious that vacancy is something you should think about in terms of months of empty positions, rather than positions that are filled. And we like this because you're going to see vacant positions as well on this report, empty boxes all the way across for a position. That provides you with the opportunity to ask the agencies why the position's vacant and what the agency's intentions are. It may be that that's one of the positions they intend to transfer over to shared services, or maybe they're just having recruitment difficulties, a number of things. But although this report, I think, goes a long way in giving you questions to ask and helping you understand vacancy, it still doesn't provide all the information you need. By now, you should understand that it's critical to understand the fund sources as well as the vacancy factor itself, and to find out what kind of funding is used to pay for positions is something that goes on the next slide.
Yes, you're going to go back to page 10. So the Pioneer Home received $4.1 million less than I thought they were going to realize. A lot of the fund sources didn't come through except for general funds. And can we assume that happened in the prior year too? So let's say this is a flat-funded agency. Can we assume that that's been a sort of static $46.8 million that they've been receiving? Or should we assume this is $4 million worse than they did last year? Or can we not assume any of that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, what we did is we looked at 17 actuals compared to the 17 budget. And then we used the ratio of what they were able to collect and applied that to the 19 budget. So we don't know if this is what they're actually going to receive in 19, but based on my knowledge of the Pioneer Homes budget, I think it's a reasonable estimate of what they probably will be able to receive in FY19. And this is, their budget looks very different than it did in FY15 when they had $3 million more of UGF and they had less of the other fund sources, but there's been a push to find other revenue sources in Pioneer Homes like there has been in many other departments and in many other divisions. And you can see the impact of that here is that they have had to maintain a higher vacancy. I'm going to turn to this.
Stay there for a second.
Oh, okay.
Just, I'd like to add just a technical correction. You said $4 million less than they thought they had. No, they knew about $739 of it. The uncollectible receipts caused them to have an additional 3.4. So their total is 4.1 million. It's not new 4.1. But the right. Again, the point is, when you have uncollectible receipts, it adds a kind of vacancy factor that isn't necessarily visible until you look at your fund sources. Now, this is based on 17 because we have actuals. You can look at 18, and you would probably see about the same fund sources in about the same amounts. And 19 is going to show you similar fund source, similar amounts. If they're different, then you would say, this analysis falls apart. It needs to be adjusted by the changes since 17. But as Amanda says, in Pioneer's home, the changes occurred in 15. There haven't been changes since 17.
One more question there.
Yeah. And before we go on, I just want to make sure that, is there any advantage? I mean, we're seeing a tremendous disadvantage to having a budget with uncollectible receipts. But we've gotten requests numerous times for additional federal receipt authority. And so is there any advantage to a agency by putting in these hollow authorities?
Mr. Chairman, there are some advantages. If they are able to, if pharmaceutical sales go way up, they're able to spend the money that they have. They don't have to go to LBNA, so it reduces administrative costs of trying to request additional additional funding. So it's not a bad thing to have some additional authority. It's when you have too much additional authority that it really skews the budget. Some additional authority can promote more administrative efficiencies because you don't have to come ask for additional funding if you have another paying resident who really wants to pay, but now you can't spend any more money, even though you have somebody coming in saying, well, I have money here, and you're saying, sorry, the legislature didn't give us enough receipt authority, so we're limited. Oh, boy, they sound great. So if you have somebody who's willing to pay, and you say, great, I can now hire another person because there's somebody, we have a bed open, and we have the receipt authority, and you're willing to pay, so we can hire another person, and we can have another person in a bed. But if you can't collect it, you still have the vacant bed. If you can collect it, you can fill beds. So there is an advantage. It's just that discrepancy, the large discrepancies that are problematic.
So if you have this differential between the vacancy factor and so you're having to leave positions open, it might mean that you're not hiring nurses so that you can't fill beds because you don't have personnel to service them. Is that correct as well?
Mr. Chairman, it is, but to go just take a step back, Amanda mentioned it's the amount. Well, remember, federal receipts, you can go to LBNA. But at 98%, are you really going to cut that back? Why? It's inefficient. I don't want to go to LBNA every year. And it's not that much money. Your statutory designated program receipts, you can go to LBNA and get more if you need it. Interagency receipts, they can be unbudgeted if you need it. you want them to be. So the real problem here is general fund program receipts. And as Amanda says, you don't have to have 100% in each of these columns or even 98%. This is a problem. Your IRA receipts being budgeted at $2 million more than you are going to collect. And even program receipts at $1 million more. It's distorting. It's, I don't know that it's misleading the legislature into thinking that Pioneers Homes has more than it has, but I think most people would look at the budget and say, it's $50 million. They won't understand that it's really 46. They won't understand that, as Amanda was explaining, just tell me why grandma can't get in. I know they've got empty beds. And knowing that the reason she can't get in is because program receipts don't cover the full cost of the thing, of the room, and they don't have any general funds. They can't fill the bed, even though they've got the program receipt authority and you're willing to pay. It still may be that if you're paying, make up a number, $50,000, that it requires a GF subsidy of 10 or 15, then I'd like to take your money, but I can't because I don't have the general funds that effectively match your program receipts. So they, and as you noted, the big disadvantage comes in the healthcare costs. If I were managing this, I would seriously cut program receipt authority and interagency receipt authority, because as Amanda explained, having them on the books costs them at least a position and maybe two, just because they're carrying hollow receipts. And so you get hit with charges to your health insurance from program receipts that you are not going to collect and must pay for it with general fund with general funds. And it's a bad thing for the agency to do, and misleading for the legislature and anybody else looking at their budget.
And one thing I would like to add is when we were talking about myths of $300 to $400 million, I think this is another issue. Let's say if the subcommittee went in and said, okay, we're going to clean up the books this year, we're going to remove 100% of this uncollectible money, and we're reducing Pioneer Homes' budget by $3.4 million, and we're getting back to, you know, we're just going to remove that funding from their budget. Then the next year, what you would probably see in management plan is you will probably see the department come in and say, okay, now that they've cleaned up the books, they can't afford, they just don't need these 47 positions. They haven't been funded. They've been sitting on the books unfunded all this time because of these uncollectible receipts. And so we're gonna get rid of 39 of these positions. We're going to bring it down to an eight position full-time equivalent. Well, then the next year, you're going to have people say, well, wait a second. Each of these 39 positions had UGF associated with those positions. Why didn't you cut the UGF funding? Well, because the UGF funding was not paying for these 47 positions. If you cut the UGF, nothing was paying. They couldn't be paid. So if you then go back and you cut the UGF associated with these 39 vacant positions that can't be funded, because right now, if you go through and count the little empty boxes and those little checkbox reports, they have more than 500 vacant months currently, then you will have to then reduce. You're going to end up with a lot more vacant positions in Pioneer Homes, because the UGF that was really funding all, you have to look at it as a pot of money funding the full myriad of positions. You can't really tie each single individual position to position, which is why I think when you say, how do I find money that is looking, how do I find what money is allocated, that is where you need to go to your personal services detail report, which is what it's in each of your subcommittee books. And before, if I ever want to find out, okay, what's going on in an agency's budget, and can I cut, or what funding sources are used to pay positions, I tend to say, oh, Pioneer Homes. I see that the majority of their funding is spent in column five on $50 million of their $61 million is spent on personal services. A lot of people are paid from this budget. So the first column is the 17 actual expenditures, and I'm going to compare that to the governor's request. The 17 actuals is $5.6 million higher than the governor's request. I look at that and say, wow, $9.9 million. Can I cut back to 17 and not impact Pioneer Homes? No, because when you go to the fund sources, and I like the fund summary to begin with, Pioneer Homes is actually $699,200 in UGF below what was expended in FY17. That's 1.8% below the 17 actuals. But these other numbers give me a very strong indication that there may be, and I'm just saying may be, hollow authorization. I know there is, but in other divisions, I would indicate maybe. And then I would go up and look at the individual fund sources. I ignore sometimes the vacancy factor and all of that. I look at really what is the pot of money that they have to spend, because that is what the division has to spend for their operations. And I would say no, they're actually below 17 in UGF, and a lot of this other money is hollow. This 600 million, just remember, there's 600 million below, but I had already stated before that they also have in the 19 numbers almost 600,000 of additional health care costs. So if you're looking at across the board, they really have 1.2 million less of UGF to spend in 19 than they had in 17. You're looking at 12 fewer positions, I would say. This is all rough estimates, but I would say it's indicative of what I understand is truly going on in the Pioneer Homes at this point.
The point is that this money, the $5.6 million increase from 17 actuals, is not UGF. It is money that doesn't exist. It's hollow authorization. They're not going to collect it. And both the legislature and Pioneer's Homes would probably be better off if this hollow authorization were removed.
Any questions? All right.
I think subcommittees are going to have a lot of work to figure out this stuff in detail.
Yeah, if you could go back to page 10. So, again, but that's the one that has the budget numbers. Tell me where I might be wrong on this. So let's look at the amount of money that they thought that they said, this is what we need to produce this level of services this year after the vacancy factor. So $50 million, $150.151 million, that middle column?
Yes.
Okay. So they came in and with a rosy picture, you know, hoping that they were going to get all the fund sources that they actually didn't get in the end. They said, we're going to be able to fill this number of beds, we're going to be able to hire this number of people, we're going to provide this level of quality food service. And at the end, it turned out maybe they should have known, maybe they shouldn't have, but they received $3.3 million less than they thought, and they didn't provide that $50 million worth of services. They were only able to provide the $46 million of services. Is it fair then, when they come back next year and say, well, gosh, it's the $50.151 million worth of services we want to provide for beds, to provide services to people, to provide food to people. I guess we'll hear, gosh, your proposed budget is $3.3 million over your actuals 2 years ago. But isn't the middle number the sort of level of services they want to provide, or do we not know? I mean, we're going to have this argument over actuals and, your proposed budget is higher than your actuals, and we know your actuals were lower because you didn't collect funds that you had hoped to collect. Is it fair to look at that middle number and say that's the level of services they wanted and they proposed to provide? Because they will itemize the level of services they're going to provide under that 50.1 number, right?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think you can see from the allocation totals report that they didn't provide 50. I mean, we were looking only at personal services in chart 10 or graph 10. And here you can see that personal services really were closer to the 46 that we got by taking some ratios. So they may want to provide $50 million, but they're funded at 46. The budgeted at 50, funded at 46, providing $46 million worth of services. So if you want them to provide $50 million of services, one choice is give them another $3.5 million of GF. Another is to make sure that these uncollectible fund sources, whether it's Medicaid or program receipts, gets collected. That's more difficult to do. But there are always several places to look at in a budget to get where you want to go. And that's what makes budgeting tough.
Just one thought.
Well, I think we're going to have to go on because we're a half hour over and people are needing to go to meetings. So do you want to go ahead and run through the end here? We're probably going to have to have you come back and do some follow-up questions.
All right. As I said, the first place I always look is allocation totals. Then I would go to the personal services detail and really see what I've determined, are they collectible or not? Then go to the personal services detail and say, is it reasonable that the positions are actually collectible? And then talk to your LFD analyst and department staff. I think what Representative Wilson was just asking with the governor's office, it's a good place to start.
Well, and we know that the approach that we're talking about here takes a lot of time and effort. But it's going to be much more productive effort than simply asking the department for a list of vacant positions, then deleting the positions and funding. And Amanda has a number of words of caution on that simple approach.
I think, first of all, lists of vacant positions are a point in time. You don't know if the executive branch plans to fill those positions, and if you delete them, you may be deleting services that you want them to provide. The second thing is it may take time to recruit the right position. For example, a few years ago, I was in banking, and I was at Commerce as the director of admin services there, and banking and securities, after the 2009 banking failure, they had about 50% of their staff was hired by the feds because there was such a demand for bank examiners. As a result, you had 50% vacancy. Well, they ended up, you know, it took time to recruit additional banking examiners, but if you had deleted those positions in the funding, what they did is they took the position funding and they contracted out for those services. Had you deleted the funding associated with those positions, they would no longer have been able to contract out. DOT does the same kind of thing with engineers. It's a highly specialized field, and so they may, while they're recruiting for an engineer position, they may contract out for those services with a private engineering firm. You want to be very careful about saying, vacant position, I'm just going to delete the funding without understanding what you're doing. Also, as we know, that a lot of the vacant positions, there's insufficient funding to pay for all of those budgeted positions. I think the Pioneer Homes illustrates that. If you delete the GF, you're actually going to create larger vacancies in the Pioneer Homes. And then when multiple fund sources exist in a budget, make sure you look at the total pot of money that is available and determine whether the deletion that you're expecting or the addition makes sense. And remember that when positions are vacant, they may be vacant because they are funded with uncollectible fund sources.
Slide 17 starts with something that may appear to be flippant. It's not intended to be. It's just a shorthand way of referring to stuff like YouTube videos where they show some stunt where the caption on the bottom is you know, of a video of a stunt driver doing some strange things in a car. And they'll say, kids, don't try this at home. Stunts were performed by a professional driver on a closed course, and that's what we're referring to. We don't mean to tell you to stay away from addressing personal service costs. The statement is intended to encourage you to become professional drivers. And we think you can do that by keeping some of these in mind, some of these points in mind.
I think just don't make assumptions, particularly that cutting UGF associated with a vacant position won't have any impacts. Use resources available to you, and that's not just our reports, which I think are very helpful, but people, you know, the department and Ledge Finance. Understand the impacts. And as an aide stated in a recent meeting, don't go down the position rabbit hole. If the agency doesn't have the funding to keep the position, keeping it on the books doesn't cost anything, but deleting the position actually may cost. Because if you have to recreate the position, for example, the bank examiners, recreating the positions takes time, and you may actually be spending more money because you are paying more for a contractor when you could have hired a position, but you have to go through all the red tape to get your position back. So many times deleting positions can be problematic and actually will cost the state more money. So cutting positions to the bone may actually increase costs. And finally, remember that money appears in position detail reports. It's not necessarily real money.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I think that we're all more knowledgeable than we were when we started. It is now at 4:07, and sorry for keeping us, but we've got a full schedule, and with that, we'll be adjourned.